source of information. It's a wonderful news aggregator, and there's a tremendous amount of very, very important opinion that's on there as well. If you just search my name, it'll hook you in, and there's several years worth of pieces by me in there.
And we're all in this together for sure. Thank you so much. We'll look forward to speaking with you again in the future. Thank you.
I hope so, Bert. Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
There once was a union maid who never was afraid. But the goons and the geeks and the company finks and the deputy sheriffs who made the raid. And when the news was called, she went to the union hall. And when the Legion boys came round, she always stood her ground.
Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. Wise to the tricks of company spies. She couldn't be fooled by the company stool. She'd always organize the guys. She'd always get her way. When she strived for better pay, she'd show her card to the National Guard, and this is what she'd say. Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking with the union. I'm sticking with the union. I'm sticking with the union.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present Long Strange Trip, the history of the Grateful Dead, Saturday, August 21st at 6 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. This Grateful Dead documentary will be shown as a benefit for KBOO to celebrate 20 years of Grateful Dead and Friends on the air. This is an all-ages event, and masks are required. You can buy tickets at kboo.fm and support KBOO getting a new studio transmitter link. Again, that's Long Strange Trip, a benefit for KBOO at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland, on Saturday, August 21st at 6 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing, unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. It is time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this August 16th Monday. This morning on the Old Mole, Bill Resnick interviews Reggie Williams, a vice president of the Commonwealth Fund, whose singular objective is improving the U.S. healthcare system. Their most recent evaluation and report that Williams supervised and authored compared the U.S. healthcare system to 10 other high-income countries on the quality of care, access to it, price, and some 70 other measures. The U.S. ranked dead last, and by a lot. Bill and Reggie Williams also discuss what the U.S. must do to improve. Last month, on July 28, 2021, journalist and executive editor of Black Agenda Report, Glenn Ford, died at the age of 71. Black Agenda Report provides news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left, and the loss of the voice and dedication of Glenn Ford at such a young age is a tragic one indeed. This morning from the archive, we replay a February 2019 interview with Old Mole Laurie Mercier talking with Glenn Ford. As the Trump administration entered its final year, they discussed an electoral strategy for the left. What's a socialist to do? Do any Democratic candidates offer any possibility for real change? We will be visiting upon that question once again as we move into the midterm elections, an always relevant question as we move through the electoral process every couple years. We'll look again at the cause for Medicare for All, with Desiree Hellegers bringing voices from the July 24th Medicare for All rally in Portland, which was part of a national day of action. The Portland rally was sponsored by the Portland chapter of Democratic Socialists of America, DSA, Jobs with Justice, and a host of other community organizations set on demonstrating that the fight for universal health care is just getting started. I'd like to remind our listeners that the Old Mole is hosting an online photographic retrospective, 30 Years in the Streets of Portland, the Activist Photography of Betty Lee. You can view Betty's photos with her reflections on the KABU website by searching for Betty Lee, B-E-T-T-E-L-E-E, or by visiting the Old Mole Facebook page. And thanks to Old Mole Patricia Kohlberg for her hard work in support of this important retrospective. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KABU members, old and new, for supporting community radio and programs like the Old Mole. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole on KABU's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, or download the Old Mole podcast and listen on the go. And now, Bill Resnick and Reggie Williams.
Hi, Reginald Williams. Welcome to KABU here in Portland, Oregon.
Hi, Bill. Thank you. Excited to be here and speak about our new report.
Reggie Williams is the Vice President of the International Health Policy and Practice Innovation Programs at the Commonwealth Fund. It has a singular purpose, the fund, to improve the U.S. healthcare system. To do that, it continuously evaluates U.S. healthcare. It compares it to other healthcare systems, and it makes and supports recommendations, especially in its latest report released last week. Its research and writing was led by Reggie Williams. The report found the U.S. dead last in the quality of its healthcare system behind 10 other industrialized nations, including England and Canada, France, Germany, six others. Reggie Williams, tell us about the report. Why was the U.S. found dead last, despite outspending every other nation, at least by, I understand, 2-1, for some countries even more? Then we'll get to what must be done in this country.
Well, thank you for that. So we have international research that we do where we look at the healthcare experience of people across 11 high-income countries. And so we do surveys with people in the U.S. and in other countries, but we also evaluate data from organizations like the World Health Organization and the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. And so when we looked at 71 specific measures, we were able to evaluate the U.S. healthcare system and other healthcare systems across things like access to care, care process, administrative efficiency, equity, and the very important healthcare outcomes. And as you stated, the U.S. came in last overall when we ranked and evaluated countries on their performance. And I think despite all of the spending that we have in our U.S. healthcare system, we're still ranking last. And we're really an outlier when you look at our performance compared to other countries, particularly when you look at issues of people being able to find care and for people to be able to afford care. We just are not achieving the outcomes that we ultimately would like.
There's also, my understanding is, other deficiencies in long-term care, that is often called nursing homes. The Medicaid amounts that poor people may be eligible for are grossly insufficient, and the homes are often very deplorable. And affluent families, of course, go to private care systems. Reggie Williams, my sense is that the unaffordability is not just poor people. It's also people with what's called decent health insurance, where the co-pays are enormous. If I understand the report, something like the average family of four can be spending over $20,000 a year on health payments in addition to what the health insurance companies pay. That is, their out-of-pocket costs, even if they have employee health care, is enormous.
That was one of the major findings from our report, that the affordability of care is really holding people back from accessing healthcare services. Our analysis and our data shows that low-income individuals in the United States, people with lower incomes, are 50% more likely to forego care because of the economic costs associated with the care. And so the burden of having to pay for care out of pocket is really keeping people from doing the things that we want them to do in going to see the doctor, filling prescriptions, being able to manage and treat a chronic condition over the long term. And so when you compare that to other countries where individuals of high income don't face that same burden, or low income don't face that same burden, there's a lot of disparity for people in the United States.
Reggie Williams, today the Delta variant of the COVID virus is raging across the country, especially in states with very low vaccination levels and terrible leadership. Tell us what's happened to the public health system over the years. I understand that was one of the measures. And what has to be done now?
Yes. Our report doesn't look specifically at the experience of COVID-19 in the different countries, but what it does is it really kind of understands and interrogates that baseline healthcare system that people were experiencing during the pandemic. And so you can really predict, because of the lack of access barriers that people face, that we'd be struggling where we are with vaccination right now because the people do not have the same access to care. And that's particularly important for access to primary care. And so from some other research that we have done, we have found that people that are kind of on the fence about vaccination, one of the things that would kind of change their engagement around vaccination, lead them to get an appointment and ultimately get the vaccination, would be having access to a trusted primary care source. And from our research, we find that many Americans do not have access to a regular primary care source. And if they do have access, they don't have access after hours or on the weekends when working people may want care. And that's dramatically different from how other people in other countries have a relationship with the healthcare system. You can look in Netherlands, Norway. It's really easy to engage your primary care provider, say, after hours or on the weekend. If you look at the UK and the success that they've had in rolling out vaccination, they've utilized that regular source of care, that primary care physician in their community, as a way to bring people in to the clinics to receive their vaccinations. We simply don't have the same analogous structure here, which is why I think we see people in the US saying, we would like to talk to healthcare professionals and engage them in this conversation about the questions I have so that I can make a decision and feel confident about taking the vaccine.
Hi, folks. Bill Resnick here talking to Reggie Williams of the Commonwealth Fund, whose singular purpose is analyzing and improving the U.S. healthcare system. One major way it does it is to compare it to healthcare systems around the world. Reggie Williams led this year's study. We've so far discussed this country's many deficiencies, why it ranked dead last by a big margin in this year's study that's available at the Commonwealth Fund website. Mirror, Mirror is the title. We've also begun discussing improvements. One so blatantly obvious to today, why it needs to prioritize funding on making sure that healthcare services are available to people easily, and so that it could quickly respond to virus outbreaks. Reggie Williams, let's discuss how to cover everybody to create a universal system. The fund has studied many other systems around the world, examining them. All the high-income countries on this planet have systems of universal care. Everybody is covered, but not all systems have the government as the single payer. In fact, a number of well-performing systems do use private insurance companies, like in the U.S., but unlike the U.S., those companies are under tight state regulation. For example, there have to be nonprofit. Ours are enormously profitable, and the profits do not get siphoned to the people who need it. Tell us about the differences between the insurance companies of, let's say, Germany and those in the U.S.
What's clear from our study is that health insurance in America is not sufficient and protective enough, particularly of people with low incomes. There are far too many people in the United States who can't afford care that they need, and there are far too many people that are uninsured or underinsured. And so when you look at other systems of care and how they're organized in other countries, there's really a lot of focus on creating an environment where people can access healthcare services with little barriers. One of the things that we found in our study is that the administrative barriers that exist really prevent people from accessing care in a timely fashion. And so you can look at countries like Norway, one of our leading examples from our analysis, and you can see that they have instituted kind of a regional structure where payment is made to providers and done in such a way that it's universal. And so a physician knows that they are getting paid a certain amount of money for a particular service, and it's the same for all the people they see. Our system in the U.S. is not structured that way. And so the administrative complexity that comes with delivering care just makes the care delivered, the experience for providers and for patients, much more complex and efficient.
Yeah, I think getting down to specifics, the Medicaid system, the prices for a hip replacement or many, many, many other services, in fact, all of its services, is very, very low in comparison to what most doctors demand. And it seems to me that really distorts the system. Doctors who are able to get other patients don't accept Medicaid. And my sense is, at least having lived in New York for a while, but it's, I'm sure, true of other places, clinics spring up to serve Medicaid patients, but the service is sometimes inferior, and sometimes it's just billed. When the people come in the door, they bill a bunch of services and then usher them out. It's not quite that brazen, but healthcare for the poor, it's pretty clear why people in some places just don't go to the local clinics that will accept Medicaid, because it may be worse than just suffering the disease, of course, until it gets too severe.
I think it's a fair point. Because of the complexity of our healthcare system, there are many different kind of layers and tiers to what people have access to. And so if our goal is to ensure that people have affordable, high-quality coverage, we have to put in place standards so that whether you are paying out of pocket, you are a Medicaid patient, you're a Medicare patient, you have employee and sponsored insurance, that you get access to high-quality care. And that's where some of the benefits that were articulated in the Affordable Care Act, where you have certain standards for essential benefits that health insurers are required to offer. I think where we have a lot of work to do is to ensure that the services that are deemed kind of essential are affordable for everyone, and trying to find ways to create protections so that the out-of-pocket cost associated with care does not become a deterrent for people accessing and getting the care they need.
Reggie Williams, it seems to me in this country, in fact, it's indisputable in this country, we have a growing movement, not so much for reforming the insurance companies, but more going straight to a single-payer system, which they call Medicare for All, because this country actually does have one very successful single-payer system. In fact, more than one, the Veterans Administration, which is often pilloried in the press, but in fact gets high grades from professionals who look at its outcomes and the way they operate. In any event, we could quite easily expand Medicare to cover everybody, which the public in polls supports, although it's not quite clear what that means, the support for a government-funded health care program. In any event, as opposed to trying to reform the very profit-making insurance companies, my sense is that it might be more feasible just to go for Medicare for All, because people understand what it means, and it makes it much harder for the insurance companies to denigrate a Medicare for All system. Where does the Commonwealth Fund stand on that issue?
I always like to step back away from Medicare for All specifically and really kind of look at the issue of universal health coverage. There are many different ways to ensure that people in a nation have universal health insurance coverage. Yes, there are single-payer models like what we see in the United Kingdom, and that is a single-payer, that is a government-delivered healthcare system. But if you look at countries like Australia, the Netherlands, Switzerland, they have a mix of public and private insurance that is regulated, but also ensures that everyone gets access to care. And so I think given a lot of the policy interest, ensuring that everyone has equal access to health care, you can do it with a mix of public and private insurance. Many of the countries that are a part of our mirror-mirror analysis have done just that. But you have to kind of create the opportunity to do so. And that's why in the structure that we have now, you could see a world where you build on the Affordable Care Act. You build on the existing Medicare program. You build on the existing state Medicaid programs to achieve that universal health care coverage, but then create the requirements for what the benefits are and how much that is going to cost individuals to access care can provide a good system and looks very similar to what we see in many other countries.
Reggie Williams, thanks for talking to us. We didn't get to all of the things I hoped to have talked about, but thanks a lot for talking to cable listeners today.
Thank you, and we would certainly love the opportunity to speak more about how we ensure that Americans get access to high quality and affordable care. So thank you, Bill. Thank you.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. You just heard Bill Resnick and Reggie Williams talking about the U.S. healthcare system, followed by music from Hal Singer, Malcolm X, from his album Paris Soul Food. Later on, the Old Mole will conclude with Desiree Helgers, who brings voices from the July 24th Medicare for All rally in Portland, sponsored by a whole host of progressive organizations, including Jobs with Justice and the Portland chapter of Democratic Socialists of America. The fight for universal health care is just getting started. Next on the Old Mole, a tribute to Glenn Ford, executive director of Black Agenda Report, who died at the age of 71 on July 28th, just this last month, 2021. Glenn Ford was a real go-to for myself and for many of the moles, was an amazing voice for Black liberation and for liberation of all people. There's been much written about Glenn Ford and his important work as a journalist and activist. Many, many resources to mine about the life and contributions of Glenn Ford. From his daughter, Nia Ford wrote a piece for Black Agenda Report called Power to the People. We'll link to this piece on our Mole page, but I offer you this tidbit from Nia about her father. Quote, "As I mentioned, my father had hope. His hope was reflected in his never-ending push for the liberation of Black people. That hope was demonstrated as he mentored both peers and the next generation alike. He had something to say, and he wanted you to hear it. Sometimes he said what others wouldn't say. Sometimes he said what others didn't want to hear. He was bold, he was brave, and he created and left us an amazing body of work to teach the next generation. He did his part. Now it's time for you to take the baton." That was Nia Ford from her piece on Black Agenda Report, Power to the People. Again, we'll link to that on our Mole page. We'll turn now to the archive. Glenn Ford appeared on the Old Mole just one time, but also was on KBOO many, many times, including Hard Knock Radio and other public affairs programming. Lori Mercier talked with Glenn Ford on the Old Mole back in February 2019 as the Trump administration entered its final year. They discussed an electoral strategy for the left. What's a socialist to do? Lori?
Thanks, Denise. It's a great honor to have with us Glenn Ford, who is a dean of Black journalism, having worked as reporter, producer, and creator of forums for Black voices since the 1970s in print, radio, television, and the internet. He co-founded Black Commentator in 2002, which quickly became the most influential Black political site on the internet. And in October 2006, Ford and others left Black Commentator to launch BlackAgendaReport.com, where he is the executive editor and provides news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. The Black Agenda Report is one of our favorite websites on the Old Mole Variety Hour, so we're really happy to have you here. Glenn Ford, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks so much for the invitation.
You have a recent piece in Black Agenda Report that claims that Bernie Sanders is trying to steal the rich man's party. What do the ruling class find so frightening about Sanders' run?
Well, the consensus among the ruling class, and it's a hard and fast consensus, is for austerity and war, endless austerity and endless war. What Bernie Sanders is doing is pushing for supermajority proposals. That is, there is a consensus among the American electorate around Medicare for All, which commands the allegiance of about 85% of the Democratic Party and even majorities of the Republican Party, and for free higher education, and now this Green New Deal proposal, which also commands supermajority support and about half of the Republican Party. So here we have a ruling class whose primary party, by the way, now is the Democratic Party, not the Republican Party. The Democratic Party is the party that expresses the consensus of the ruling class. And so we have a Democratic Party controlled by a ruling class that is demanding, imposing forever austerity and war, and a populace that is squarely on the side of the proposals that are personified by Bernie Sanders. So they are on a collision course.
So you, many of your pieces emphasize that Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez and others who are left-leaning within the Democratic Party are not real socialists, but really more like social democrats on the European model, and identify themselves with policies that are more akin to the New Deal Democrats, or you might say Great Society Democrats. Democratic political party has not really embraced for many decades. But why would these fairly mild proposals for Medicare for all, free higher education, why would those be so threatening?
Because the ruling class consensus is for endless austerity, and it's the same in Europe, which is causing the social breakdowns, the deterioration of relations between the people and the state in Europe. Europe's ruling class also is for endless austerity and for acceptance of the U.S.'s endless wars. So that's why they are at loggerheads. You know, Medicare for all would actually be a beneficial in the short term, in the immediate term, a beneficial program for all businesses that employ lots of people, because it decreases the cost of labor to the company. But almost all business groupings oppose it, and they oppose it because they are for austerity. And Medicare for all is seen as a kind of Pandora's box. Once you allow that kind of entitlement to be enacted, then you're opening up the floodgates to all the other entitlements that would follow. And so they oppose Medicare for all, as well as the rest of the agenda. So that's their hard and fast position. It is the ruling class consensus, and they're not going to brook any compromise with it.
But you also note that supporting these proposals would undoubtedly unleash pressures to dramatically shrink the war budget. But is that part of this new social democratic movement to dramatically decrease the war budget?
No, and we can see it in practice in the way the Democrats caved, not only accepting the biggest war budget in history, but accepting a war budget that was bigger than what Trump asked for the last time around. It's the great contradiction in what passes for a left in the United States, that they are pro-imperialist. In real socialist terms, we call these folks social imperialists. They want something like social democracy for their own populations while waging predatory wars on working class people and around the world. They have no solidarity in their socialism.
And certainly that's represented by the lack of action or speaking out against the intervention in Venezuela and the planned coup in Venezuela.
Oh, of course. Bernie Sanders described the late Hugo Chavez as a dead communist dictator. Venezuela has had more free and fair elections not only than the United States, but more in the 21st century than any country in the world. It is probably, demonstrably, the most bourgeois democratic government in the world. Having put its constitutional revisions and countless elections to the popular test and passed that test over and over again. But Bernie Sanders joins the corporate media chorus, the whole bourgeois Mormon tabernacle choir of lies about Venezuela.
However, I mean, to Sanders' credit, he did speak out against intervention, didn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe this is all one can hope for in the American political scene, speaking out against intervention even while condemning the so-called dictator.
That's right. He's less of an aggressive imperialist. His latest statement on Venezuela warns against the more muscular kind of U.S. imperialism, while at the same time lying about Venezuela and essentially giving a justification for some kind of move against Venezuela. We used to call that wishy-washy, but when literally millions of Venezuelan lives and Latin American lives is at stake, wishy-washy is far too weak a word for these social imperialists of the so-called left.
Well, what are ways that the Democratic Party are attempting to sabotage Sanders' campaign, especially with any number of candidates who have announced their run for the presidency?
Well, first, it's the rush of early candidacies that we saw. It was as if the Democratic Party and its corporate media backers were in a panic to show that Sanders is irrelevant, that he's left the train. Look, we've already got a full-blown cast of characters. We've got two black senators out there. And so it was very, very clear that the early nature project of the Democrats was to preempt Sanders. And that meant actually not mentioning him, if at all possible, in the corporate media. It was if Sanders wasn't in the room when he, in fact, was the five-ton gorilla in the room, the specter that they were all terrified of.
Well, clearly the Democratic establishment sees the African-American vote as key to propelling particular candidates forward. And you've been particularly critical, I think, of Kamala Harris. What are her flaws?
Actually, from the beginnings of the Black Commentator and throughout the history of Black Agenda Report, we've been most critical of Cory Booker. Cory Booker is almost a laughable prospect in if he's to be characterized as some kind of progressive Democrat. He comes from the most reactionary circles of the Democratic Party. Back at the turn of the 21st century, Cory Booker was running two private schools in Newark. He was an advocate of private school vouchers. He was an early founder of these front organizations for hard right corporatist Betsy DeVos forces out there, who were defending segregation academies. This is before charter schools became the favorite of the school privatizers. And Cory Booker was deeply allied with them. They're the folks who provided the millions of dollars that gave him national prominence in his first and second runs for mayor of Newark, New Jersey. That's what made him one of the great black hopes and a potential of having been, of becoming the first Obama. But Kamala Harris is the front runner in terms of being the black candidate to derail Bernie Sanders, not Cory Booker. And that's why we've paid more attention to her early campaign.
But historically, there is this black tradition of skepticism of power, and you've written about how black Americans, for the most part, are in huge majorities against U.S. imperial adventures. They're more wise to the kind of corporate takeover of the U.S. So why would most African Americans in the country be persuaded by some of these faux progressive candidates?
Because the duopoly system is a trap that in the end compels black Democrats to vote against their own very left-wing political inclinations. The two-party system is in fact a one-party system for black people, because one of the parties is always the white man's party, a party that is white supremacist and for which white supremacy is the main organizing principle, and that is the Democratic Party. The Republican Party. So therefore there is only, in terms of the duopoly, the Democratic Party. And black folks' first priority is to defeat the white man's party. And so in Democratic primaries, and this is the great irony and symptomatic of the trap, black Democrats vote for the candidate that they believe is best suited to defeat the white man's party. And that usually means the best financed and funded candidate, which turns out to be the corporate candidate. So even though black folks, by all measures and for generations, have clearly been the most left-wing and the most anti-war and pro-peace constituency in the United States, they tend in these primaries to vote for the corporate candidate.
And one can understand that need for or belief in self-preservation as sort of necessary actions. But Glenn Ford, in the remaining minutes that we have, what's a socialist to do given the duopoly and the electoral process such as it is in this country? What do you find as hopeful signs or models for organizing?
Well, I think that this election has great promise. I want to make it very clear that nobody at Black Agenda Report is a Democrat, and all of us are anti-imperialists, and all of us are socialists, and there is zero possibility that we would wind up endorsing a Democrat. But our job is to provide analysis.
Yes.
And our analysis is that this election could be very, very productive for the left. I personally believe that there is no way in hell that the main party now of the ruling class, the Democrats, are going to allow their consensus on endless austerity and war to be busted by Bernie Sanders. And they are going to undermine and sabotage his campaign in ways that are so blatant, so public, so undemocratic, that millions of people who thought that the only way to move is to be a Democrat will be so damn disgusted that we'll see a radicalization of unprecedented numbers of people, providing the human capital that can make a real struggle for peace and socialism possible.
Glenn Ford, thank you so much for joining us today. And we want to remind listeners to check out the Black Agenda Report, fantastic website full of news, commentary, and analysis, such as you've heard today from Glenn Ford. Thanks again.
Thanks for inviting me.
All aboard the night train.
Glenn Ford, Executive Editor, BlackAgendaReport.com. Well, the crisis stems from the contradictions between two main currents in black politics. One sometimes is called the assimilationist current, and that is that the struggle is about equality and nothing else, citizenship rights and nothing else. To become Americans, and that's it. And once we have achieved this Americanness, then the movement is over. The other current is, I call, the self-determinationist current, which recognizes African Americans as a distinct people, having become a distinct people here in this country, who have the right to choose their own political path. To express, to try to build a world as they see it, based upon a world view that they are entitled to because of their peoplehood, which they achieved in this country. And And often, certainly all the way through the 60s, these two currents ran parallel to each other in the same direction. However, once we achieved legal status as full Americans, the contradictions between the two currents, the one that would just like to assimilate and measured its progress by how American-like we were, and the other, which wanted to express our view of the world, to shape the world as we thought it should be shaped. That's that of course is done politically. There was a divergence there. These contradictions have come to the inevitable head with the election of Barack Obama. It certainly is a profound change in terms of that current that seeks to be totally integrated into this American project. It does not challenge that American project, a project that began with genocide and enslavement and continues as imperialism. For those who simply wanted to integrate into this American project, to, as Martin Luther King once said to Harry Belafonte, run into a burning house, this is the epiphany. This is the end of things. This is the reason to call a halt to the movement. But for those of us whose project is not one, is not a continuation of this American project from genocide and slavery and now to imperialism, certainly that was no signal for us to end our struggle.
I can't repeat here what Glenn Ford once said about James Brown, but tune in to Black Power Media and listen to Jared Ball's commemoration, Glenn Ford, the James Brown of Black Radical Media. We will link to it on the Old Mole Post for today's show at kboo.fm, Old Mole Variety Hour. That was James Brown, Night Train. We conclude our program this morning with voices from the July 24th Medicare for All rally in Portland, which was a part of a national day of action, produced by Desiree Helliger's The Fight for Universal Healthcare is Just Getting Started.
Organize and fight. Healthcare is a human right. Dr. Antonio German, he's a clinical director and family physician at Salud Medical Center in Woodburn, and is a member of Physicians for a National Health Program.
Good afternoon, Portland. My day job is a rural family physician and a medical educator. Should healthcare be about profits or about people? Should anyone be denied access to basic life-saving care? Should it matter if you're young or old? We spend twice as much per capita on healthcare as any other nation on the planet, yet we still can't get it together to offer full comprehensive care. All of this has to do with greed and profiteering. You know that this system disproportionately affects communities of color, too. The pandemic has shined a great light on this fact. Racism and power are intertwined, and racism is a mechanism for maintaining power, and the health sector is a clear illustration of this persistent practice. So what do we need to do? We need to decide what kind of country we want to be. We need healthcare justice. We need people power.
We have Rosemary Dodd, a leader with the Portland chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America, who has organized Me Too Speak Outs, events in support of trans rights, and other campaigns. Rosemary.
Hey, everybody. It is so incredibly exciting to be out here with all of you demonstrating for Medicare for All. I'm a food service worker, and those of you who have been in that industry know that employer-provided healthcare is almost unheard of. At my last job, I was lucky enough to have employer-provided health coverage. But when they covered up a COVID outbreak, I had to quit and lost my insurance. Under an employer-based healthcare system, people working in the most precarious jobs usually don't get coverage. Or when we do, we get stuck in low-wage jobs, in underpaid jobs, in unsafe jobs, and in jobs that we hate. Raise your hand if you have ever been stuck in a job that you can't stand because you didn't want to lose your healthcare coverage. That is a lot of hands. So why is it that, instead of the government simply providing care for everybody, workers are expected to either find a job that provides it or shell out massive amounts of money a month for insurance, or worse, go without and end up using the emergency room for primary care? It is because we live in an economic and political system that is based on private profit instead of human need. Under capitalism, so many people, either through lack of insurance or denial of benefits, lose their lives. When somebody shoots you dead with a gun, that's murder. But when health executives deny life-saving care to millions because it would hurt their bottom line, that's just business. But we are out here to disrupt that business, to say that healthcare is a human right, regardless of your insurance status, your checking account balance, your zip code, or your race. The COVID-19 pandemic put into sharp relief what was already clear, that a for-profit healthcare system is utterly inadequate. It highlighted the massive health inequity in our country. We were told that the virus strikes everyone equally, rich and poor, black and white. But that's not true. It is estimated that roughly 1 out of every 3 COVID deaths is linked to health insurance gaps. That is a whole lot of people who would have been alive today if they had had health insurance to treat their underlying conditions. We all watched as Pfizer and Moderna use government-funded technology to develop vaccines, profit to the tune of billions of dollars, and then fight tooth and nail to protect their so-called intellectual property, keeping life-saving vaccines from people in the rest of the world. The vaccine is great, but we didn't need Pfizer or Moderna profiteering off a pandemic. The government could have simply developed the vaccine, distributed it for free, and exported that technology to the world, saving perhaps millions of lives. But under capitalism, the profit margins of pharmaceutical companies are more important than human life. While well over 4 million people died globally from the pandemic, U.S. billionaires raked in $1.8 trillion. Can you imagine all the things we could do with that money? When we win Medicare for All, and we are going to win, we need to make sure it's not half-assed. We need to demand high-quality, free-at-the-point-of-use healthcare that covers everybody's needs. We need it to be trans-inclusive. We need it to be available to immigrants. We need a massive investment in healthcare infrastructure in communities of color in poor rural areas so people don't just have healthcare on paper, they have convenient care right in their neighborhoods. But you know what politicians are gonna say? They're gonna say, oh, we can't afford all of that. Yeah, it's gonna be expensive. But if Jeff Bezos can take a joyride to space on a rocket fueled by underpaid wages, then we can take some of that money back from the rich and corporations to meet our basic needs. Now, speaking of politicians, let's talk about our Senator, Ron Wyden. He has decided to work with so-called moderates to rewrite the Medicare expansion in the budget reconciliation bill. We don't know what's going to be in his version yet, but let me share a fun fact about Senator Wyden. Since the beginning of his career, he has gotten $4.6 million from the healthcare industry. But I'm sure that's not going to influence his work on the Medicare expansion, right? Let's do a little chant to encourage him to put the health of Oregonians over his corporate donors. But I'm going to need you guys to chant loud, okay? Because we have to be louder than $4.6 million. So here's how it goes. Ron Wyden, tax the rich. For-profit healthcare makes us sick. Ron Wyden, tax the rich. For-profit healthcare makes us sick. Ron Wyden, tax the rich. For-profit healthcare makes us sick. For-profit healthcare makes us sick. Fantastic. Thanks, guys. So now for the most important question. How do we actually win Medicare for All? Because simply voting is not going to cut it. In this supposed democracy, 70% of people support some version of universal health care, but the corporate establishments of both parties can't get it done. When Obama had a supermajority of Democrats in both the House and the Senate, what did we get? The Affordable Care Act, which is a band-aid on a broken system, still costs hundreds of dollars a month for low-wage workers like me, It was a massive giveaway to private insurers and still left healthcare out of reach of millions. Biden has actually threatened to veto Medicare for All if it somehow found its way to his desk, against the wishes of the vast majority of Democratic voters. And we all know that the Republicans are much worse. We cannot rely on these corporate politicians to get it done for us. Whenever transformative change happens, it is because workers, oppressed people, and students come together to demand it. Like the civil rights or the anti-war movements, we have to organize mass resistance to the status quo. Every one of you who came out today is taking an important step forward in the fight for Medicare for All. It is demonstrations like this that show the politicians and ruling class that we are not going to sit back and take whatever thrums they throw at us. It is going to take sustained demonstrations to actually win Medicare for All. It is going to take labor action, including strikes. It is going to take running insurgent left-wing candidates that are accountable to our movement. It is going to take independence, political independence, from the politicians who would sabotage us. Vitally, we need to connect the movement for Medicare for All with movements like Black Lives Matter, with movements like the labor movement, the environmental justice movement, and come together in common struggle. But of course, these issues are all deeply interconnected. Most of all, it is going to take a sustained, unified movement able and willing to leverage power. After all, other universal healthcare systems, like in Canada or the UK, were won on the backs of powerful working class movements. The fight for Medicare for All is vital, but at the end of the day, as long as there is a profit motive driving our healthcare system, working class and poor people are still going to get screwed. We need to completely get rid of the private hospitals and the pharmaceutical companies that profit off of our illness and death. We need socialized medicine, a healthcare system that is owned and run democratically for the benefit of all, where all staff, from nurses to janitors, are unionized and have a say over their working conditions, where patients and not investors are put first. As a socialist, I believe that all of society should be democratically run for human need and not for the profit of a handful of billionaires. But the fight for real, transformative change, like Medicare for All, is part of that struggle for a better world. It will improve and save the lives of countless people, and the struggle to get there will build the connections between one another and help our capacity to keep winning. So keep on coming to rallies, but also see how else you can get organized. I may be biased, but I think one of the best things you can do is to join with me and the Democratic Socialists of America and organize with us to build the connections between the struggle for healthcare, between the struggles for environmental, labor, and racial justice, to raise consciousness of our collective power as a class to determine our own future, and ultimately to win a socialist world free of exploitation. But there are plenty of other ways you can get organized. Join a union, join any number of the community organizations represented here today. There are a lot of powerful forces lined up against us. The insurance and pharmaceutical companies, for-profit hospitals, the capitalist and investor classes, and the politicians they all fund. But you know what? We can win Medicare for All. We can win socialized medicine. They may have the money, they may buy the politicians, but we have the numbers and the strength and the will to protest like we are now, to withhold our labor, and to get organized and raise hell until they're forced to give us the health care that we deserve. Thank you.
Travis Nelson was also among the lineup of speakers.
I'm a Democratic Socialist, but I'm also an officer of the Democratic Party of Oregon. I represent Oregon on the Democratic National Committee, and I'm the new vice president of the Oregon Nurses Association. Medicare for All is so important to me as a nurse because I have seen the negative outcomes of patients when they have to worry about their health care. You know, like I spoke about up on stage, I've had patients who've had severe infections who did not want to get admitted and just wanted to go home on oral antibiotics when they really should have had IV antibiotics. I've seen the look in my patients' eyes when I've had to discharge them from the hospital on prescriptions I knew they couldn't afford and they knew they couldn't afford. So we need a single-payer healthcare system so that patients don't have to worry about their hospital bill when they're trying to recover. We need people to be able to not be attached to a job because they're worried about the healthcare benefits when the job is a bad job for them and the employer is treating them horribly. We need Medicare for all so that nobody, none of us, have to worry about the costs associated with our prescriptions and our healthcare and make the choice between that and whether we're going to eat tonight or not. So that's why, as a nurse, I am a strong supporter of Medicare for all.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
You've been listening to Voices from the July 24th Medicare for All rally in Portland. This has been Desiree Helgers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Community Radio. A big thank you to KBOO staff who have kept our non-commercial community radio on the air 24/7 over this last year. It takes a labor. The Old Mole comes to you every Monday, 9 a.m. Thanks to our contributors and guests for making today's show possible, Bill Resnick, Reggie Williams, Desiree Helgers, and the many dedicated activists fighting for universal health care, and from the archive, Laurie Mercier and the late Glenn Ford. You can hear The Old Mole on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, or download the Old Mole podcast and listen on the go. The Old Mole burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time, the struggles of ordinary people for democratic and sustainable ways of life. I'd also like to remind our listeners that The Old Mole is hosting an online photographic retrospective, 30 Years in the Streets of Portland, the activist photography of Betty Lee. You can view Betty Lee's photos with her reflections on the KBOO website by searching for Betty Lee, BETTELEE, or by visiting the Old Mole Facebook page. Thanks to Old Mole Patricia Kohlberg for her hard work in support of this important retrospective. Again, I'm Denise Morris. I've been your host this morning. Tune in next week for more news, views, and interviews from a socialist, feminist, and anti-racist perspective.
This is KBOO Portland.
Tune in to Talking Earth, a show dedicated to showcasing our local poetry scene. Join hosts Patrick Picard, Barbara LaMorticella, and Walt Curtis for Talking Earth on the second and third Mondays of each month from